Today's episode is brought to you by the Consultancy Growth Network. As you'll know, I'm a big believer in learning from people who've achieved the things that you want to. It's why I run this podcast, to share the stories of consulting leaders and how they've got to where they are today. So when I started talking to Mark Jansen and the team at Consultancy Growth Network, it was clear there was an obvious fit between climate consulting and their mission and what they are building with their network. But you're probably asking, what is the Consultancy Growth Network? The Consultancy Growth Network is the leading community of boutique consulting leaders. It brings together seasoned consulting growth experts who successfully scaled their own boutiques, with rapidly growing consulting founders looking to emulate their success. Now, you might be thinking, who are these growth experts? What do they actually know about consulting? And this is one of the most exciting things that personally I find about the network. The team at the Consultancy Growth Network have searched far and wide for some of the best boutique consulting leaders to help their members on their journeys, some of which I have previously interviewed for this podcast, such as Don Morehouse and Augusto Negrillo. But it's not just the insights from these people that you will benefit from. By joining, you get access to their jam-packed calendar of regular in-person and online events, their comprehensive growth hub of resources, and their active Slack community. Through all of these channels, you can learn, solve challenges, and achieve the goals you want for your firm. And now, if that wasn't enough reason to sign up, the Consultancy Growth Network is giving all listeners to this podcast a special sign-up offer. If you join for 12 months, you join for that next year, you will get your 13th month for free, giving you that extra month to continue to build on everything you're learning and continue to benefit from the network. To sign up, just visit consultancygrowthnetwork.com or contact their partnerships director, Luke, at luke@consultancygrowthnetwork.com. And when you're talking about joining, mention Create Engage or Climbing Consulting, and you will get that special sign-up offer. Hi, and welcome to Climbing Consulting. As an industry, we talk a lot about exits. We all know the story of the consulting founder who sold their business and the multiples they got or the value they got, but we hear a lot less about the other side of that coin, about the people who bought those businesses. Why did they do it? What were they looking for? What were their goals? While I have many listeners who I know are focused on exit, I also have many listeners who have that opposite goal. If this is you listening, I know that you want to build a bigger business. You want to scale your firm for more impact. And acquisitions is one of the routes to do that. So to help those of you on the buy side, I wanted to invite David Bailey onto the show to share his expertise. In this episode, David joined me to discuss his diverse career that's taken him from consulting entrepreneur to seasoned M&A advisor. Along that path, he has built his own consultancy, he has sold his own consultancy, and he's advised multiple other consulting firms, large and small, accumulating a wealth of wisdom on the power of specialization, on strategic positioning, and navigating that complex world of acquisitions. In this episode, we go deep into the buy side of acquisitions and talk all about what acquirers look for and actually what it is that can make a firm valuable and saleable. And it's worth saying, while this is buy-side focused, the advice here, if you are looking to sell your firm, will be invaluable to you too, because ultimately what David shares is the advice that you need to get your business ready to sell. Just to give you an idea, we talk about why being a generalist is actually the quickest way for your consultancy to repel potential buyers, and why it's often, if you've got 30 services, that's probably 29 too many. We talk about how to navigate the M&A maze and explain what it is that will make your firm valuable and how buyers look at your firm and what that value means to them. We also go into some of the tactics David uses from an M&A perspective. For example, actually what it is that your company's LinkedIn page could be revealing to would-be buyers that you don't expect and you need to address if you want to be seen as the right firm for them to buy. And finally, we talk about how David has crafted the successful advisory career he's had, something that I know many people want to do following the sale of their business or just following that leadership position that they've had. We talk all about why credibility is critical to this, why you need to define your own unique value proposition, and the essential steps that you will want to follow if you want to go down that same path that David did. Whether you are building a firm and are looking at acquisitions right now, or you are that consulting owner thinking about an exit and wanting to understand what the buyers that you are trying to attract will be looking for, or maybe you're just simply fascinated about deal making, this episode is packed full of invaluable advice that I know you are going to love. So with that intro done, all that's left to say is please sit back, relax, and enjoy today's episode with David Bailey. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Well, we've just had a lunch, and I always like having lunches before these because it's a great chance to catch up, get to know a bit about you. We've saved a lot of it for the show, though, so I'm very excited for this, and thank you for making the time.
Pleasure.
To kick us off, for those who may not know you, it'd be great if you could give a background on who you are and how you got to where you are today.
Sure. So I'm David Bailey. Started out in consulting, actually straight out of uni. I thought I would need something with variety, and I looked at a variety of things, and that led me to either corporate finance or consulting. And on the basis all the corporate finance houses thought I'd be better in sales and trading, and I didn't fancy doing that, I became a consultant by default. So that's how I sort of started. I decided that I would get my base training from one of the large firms, joined what was at the time Anderson Consulting, now Accenture. That was a great choice. The base training from Anderson Consulting was fantastic. Was there for 2.5-ish years and then lost the faith. I looked up the ladder I was on, up at Partnership, and saw that Partnership was another ladder sat on top of the one I was on. And the arrogance of youth made me think that perhaps I could go and do it myself. So at the ripe old age of 24, I left Anderson Consulting, and with a guy that I'd only physically met 3 times from the IT industry, we co-founded our own consulting firm. Initially focused on a very narrow niche technology called document image processing. Back then, £25,000 a workstation. Now, free with Windows. And we consulted on the technology and how to apply it to business. And then expanded the business out really in a couple of ways. One, images are a subset of documents, electronic documents, which is a subset of IT. And the other, to pay back an expensive technology, you have to cut steps out of processes. So that got you into the buzz phrase of process redesign, BPR, Six Sigma, Lean. So grew the firm in different directions over 17 years. And then in 2007, we sold out to Hitachi. They were new in consulting globally, only been going in Europe for a year, and so needed, you know, client MSAs, access to the market. And then they'd set up from scratch, and it's difficult when you're setting up from scratch. So it was easy to buy something. So they bought ours in 2007. My co-founder had the opportunity to retire as part of the deal. So that left me as running a UK region, sitting on a global consulting committee, along with a Spaniard and some Americans and some Japanese. We were trying to grow Hitachi Consulting to, you know, try and get to $1 billion, which is always a target that firms aim at. So we grew that reasonably well. And I did another acquisition with Hitachi's money to move into the ERP space. Bought a company that did Microsoft and Oracle ERP and business intelligence type implementations, which then took the UK to about 50 million sterling turnover. So a reasonable size business by then for them. And then I moved out of the line to, it was great fun actually. I was getting sort of fed up with sort of writing the budget over 19 iterations rather than a day and a half, which is what I'd used to do in my previous life. I was getting fed up with things like that and numbers, politics and staff, I broadly call it. And I moved out of the line, and Hitachi gave me a large bag of cash and asked me to wander around Europe buying consulting firms, which was a great idea. In sort of April, May 2009. But by August, I opened my bag of cash one day to find it was empty. And of course, I'd handed the UK over by then. So as I like to say, I became a free spirit, or as my wife likes to say, I lost my job. And then really having thought about other things to do and looking at maybe doing another startup, maybe joining one of the large firms, because I was reasonably well known, having taken my firm into membership of the Management Consultancies Association and eventually became president of the association. So I was reasonably well known. So some of the large brands were come and be a partner. And I thought about it and in the end decided, actually, I didn't want a full-time job anymore. So that's when I then moved into an advisory role, started advising advisory firms about their own business. So I've been doing that now for getting on 14 years.
Fantastic, David. Well, there's a lot in there, and I know we are going to talk all about your advisory career. I feel there might be a round two where we go back further and you tell me all about document image processing and how that worked. And also starting a consultancy at 24, I imagine, came with its challenges. But I don't know. That's probably one for another day. Because you were filled in a gap for me, and this might be a good jumping off point around kind of your M&A experience. Obviously, you've got tons of it, and it sounds like that, you know, going around Europe with that big bag of cash for Hitachi was the start. Just to help me, the big bag of cash being empty, so it might be an obvious question, was that because of the global financial crash, or was that because you had spent it all and you'd bought all those consultancies?
Oh, I wish it was the latter. It was the former. We got as far as finding some initial targets and starting to talk to them, and that was it. And then I couldn't take any of the potential acquisitions forward. So when I left Hitachi, I'd done two deals. One is I'd sold my own firm, and the other is I'd bought another one with their money. So I'd done one sell side and one buy side deal at that point, and quite a few more now.
I was going to say that you could call it seeing the whole process would be the
full life cycle.
And just to help our listeners, to your point, since then, and that we'll go on to talk about it today, but you've continued with that M&A and working with firms across a whole range of sort of size spectrums.
Yeah. So what I do these days tends to fall into three categories, really. Turnarounds, when firms get into trouble, and how do they get out of a mess? Growth strategies, when they get stuck. And then transactions, which could be packaging up and selling, could be using a war chest to buy, or could be going getting PE funding or debt funding or whatever.
I suspect we're going to talk about all of those today. And I think to start us off, because I know I mentioned this at lunch, but I've had guests on before who have done the sell side of that, you know, that equation. I've had very few who have actively been involved in the buy side. And I think to open this, I'd love to get your take for firms who might be looking at an exit. You know, for a lot of boutiques, that kind of exit emulating your success is what they want to do. And I've heard it, you know, from a sell side, what acquirers look like, but you are an acquirer. And I would love to get your take, you know, as someone who has been involved in a whole load of searches, like what is it that actually makes a consulting firm stand out?
Yeah, well, they can't be a me too, for a start. There are a lot of consulting firms that, as they grow, they end up, I mean, I found it with my own firm way back. You know, you wake up one morning, you realize you've got 30 people and 30 different propositions. You have as many offerings in the market as you have people, which is crazy. And then you have to pull it back in. And the key really is to not have as many propositions as people, not become effectively a generalist. So be a specialist that to help you stand out. Now, that could be in a vertical, you know, financial services only, or even within that, you know, insurance only. And then you've got a vertical knowledge and expertise you can make use of. Or it could be a horizontal, you know, buzz phrases today, cybersecurity, data analytics, those sorts of things, where you might be going cross-sector, but you are known for being a specialist. So it could be vertical, could be horizontal, could be a mixture of both. But try not to do too many things in too many places. And when I am on the acquirer side and looking out in the market, when I find those generalists, they don't get more than about 20 seconds, really. Because I sit down right at the outset with the acquirer and we talk about what are the criteria? What are we looking for? And we never say we're looking for a generalist. We're always looking for something. You know, we're looking for a particular geography with a particular skill set, with a particular sector or whatever, and of a particular size and likely value. So once you've set your criteria, then that's what you go and look for. And if you find a generalist, you're not going to spend much time on them.
I really like that frame with the criteria. And I wonder, are there any criteria that for you in these, you know, searches you do are commonplace, but maybe unexpected to others? So to your point, if you ask me to guess criteria, vertical or horizontal might feature on there, are there any criteria
that the buy side deals you've done look for, but if someone listening to this is building their firm, they may not have thought about whether they fit that.
Yes, there can be. Not always. So sometimes, for example, an acquirer might be positioned in their own market, for example, in a particular fee range. They are known for charging a particular type of price because they're positioned, I don't know, if they're a strategy house, they think they're at least as good as the big known, well-known brands, but they are 60% of the price. Then if they're going on an acquisition trail, then they don't want to be looking for firms that are charging much higher than them because that could be difficult to integrate in. And conversely, they don't want to be looking for a firm that charges half of what they do, because how can you then get them to double their prices? You can't. It takes many years to move fee rates up. So the topic of the types of fee rates that firms might charge in the market might be an unusual sort of criterion that you would think of. Now, as someone looking to, you know, package up your firm and sell it, well, that doesn't really help you too much, other than it might help you think about what types of acquirer to go and approach. It might help you with that. But that would be an example of something, I think, that might be an unusual one.
No, I hadn't thought of it, but it does, to your point, make a lot of sense. And there is that, you raise an interesting point around that searcher versus, you know, firm being, or packaging themselves for sale. And is there any advice you can give to people on that in this context? You know, if you're conducting a search, you have clear criteria. I guess, are there things that firms can do if selling is on their horizon to make themselves more attractive, or to start to think who they, you know, can they approach those acquirers as well? Or is it they need to wait and someone will come to them? You know, if you build it, they will come, so to speak.
There is an element of that. Yeah. If you build it, you get your numbers over a certain level, then you will appear on radars, most definitely. But if you are trying to get to a point in your life and you say, you know, I want to sell my firm by age 50, then you can't wait and they'll come. You have to prepare yourself. Now, I have, as many others do, I have a set of tools that I use with firms, and we're looking at, you know, trying to move about a dozen topics along a slider from the left to the right. And the more to the right we get, the more attractive we are in the market, the higher the price might be that we can attract. Some of them are obvious, like, you know, revenues need to be getting bigger, profitability needs to be getting bigger. You know, they're obviously pretty obvious things, but, you know, revenue per consultant is quite an interesting one to look at. And many firms don't measure it. You know, particularly small and medium-sized firms don't really measure revenue per consultant, but actually it can be quite an important criterion.
Why is that out of interest?
Well, it's because it's where profitability is coming from, and because profit comes from the fee rate, the utilization, and the cost of the individual. So that's where you're getting that from. So if you have a bunch of consultants who are bringing you in 40,000 a year, but they're really nice people, then actually they're eating lunch of the consultants who are bringing in 180, 200,000 a year. So you really need to be focusing in on trying to get that up. And then other things, you've got to think about, what model do you want to be? Do you want to have an employed workforce totally? Or 70-30 employee associate? Or do you want to run a model whereby you're heavily associate driven? What do you want to do? Now, there are reasons for doing any one of those types of splits between the two. But a wholly employed model tends to be more valuable in the market than a wholly associate driven model. Because, you know, what do we have in this industry? We have human beings that have arms and legs and they can walk. And associates can walk a lot more easily than employees can. So if you want to drive value up, you'll be looking to employ people, which then links again with, you need to be known for something. If you are a generalist, well, what are you hiring? What are you hiring out in the market? If you're a specialist, if you're a 40-person firm, and 35 of those consultants are insurance risk specialists, then you're going to be known as insurance risk specialists. You can attract those types of employees because they're joining a specialist club. And then equally, if you're looking to sell the firm, you know, you're going to have people knocking on your door that need to build up their insurance practice. So they all link together, these topics.
Yeah, I really like that. And this might bring it to life, just because I remember when we were speaking ahead of this, you mentioned you'd been conducting a search. And I think you said something like you looked at 100 firms, you know, over the space of, it was quite a small space of time, I remember. And you kind of, you'd very quickly judged in and out which ones were right and wrong. And it may just be what you've described there, but I'd love to know, what is it that you are looking for on that first impression? Is it, to your point, you know, the website clearly says we are insurance risk specialists, or are there other elements that will quickly tell you, yeah, this could be worth a look or couldn't be? Because I think that again might help people if they're trying to think, how do I not be a Me Too firm?
Yeah, I mean, the particular example you're using actually was in the cybersecurity space. I was looking for a cybersecurity consulting firm. And what I found very quickly was, whilst they may spray themselves as consulting firms, the vast majority of them are penetration testing organizations. And they're doing lots and lots of tiny jobs at very low fee rates. And that was not what we were looking for. And so I was able, you know, I got some lists, and it was not an area I'd particularly looked at before. So there were only a few brand names that I knew. It's a fairly, you know, new space, firms appearing from here, there, and everywhere. But I did find, I picked up the knack quite quickly of trying to work out, oh yeah, that's yet another pen test firm, move on. And then those firms don't even get to know I've looked at them.
What gave, so it sounds like you had more than just their website to go off. So this might be the answer. What was it that let you test that so quickly? To your point, you had a window on sort of project size and you could see that quite clearly. Was it, you know, what they said about themselves, I don't know, in their kind of prospectus? How could you differentiate those so quickly?
Yeah. So if they're doing cybersecurity consulting, then their relationships are going to generally be C-suite or level beneath in the organization. If they're a pen testing firm, then their testimonials are going to be from, you know, four levels down in the IT function. And so you just get a flavor quite quickly for, yeah, if your relationship's really low down there, then you're doing those lower value things. So yeah, so I was able to pick it up from there. I was also able to pick it up from if they were showing, and a number of firms didn't, but if they were showing examples of their client base, you know, bunch of logos on there, then if those logos were generally household name organizations, they were more likely to be doing the sorts of things I was looking for than if the logos were organizations I'd never really come across, because they're really dealing in the mid-market. And if they're in the mid-market, they're probably not doing the type of consulting that I was after at that point in time. So I was able to pick that sort of thing up quite quickly. And yeah, you're looking at a range of input sources. You know, there are articles written here, there, and everywhere that you can read up. There's Companies House data. There's LinkedIn. LinkedIn is a valuable source of information. You find out an awful lot from there. You know, somebody on their website says they've got 120 people, and you go on LinkedIn and you find they've got 40, and actually half of those you can tell are associates. Then you know they've got marketing speak in their website, and a bit more reality maybe on LinkedIn. LinkedIn's fantastic for gathering information.
Because I'm fascinated what those other things you look for, if I'm not asking you to share the secrets, kind of, that's a great example where LinkedIn can kind of show you what, you know, a target could really be like. What are the other go-tos for you? Are there sort of two or three other things on LinkedIn that really help you paint that picture?
Yeah, geography. So you look at where their people are, and, you know, if they've presented themselves as, we're an international firm, and you find, I don't know, maybe there are 60 people in the firm, and you find that actually 53 of them are in the UK, two are in Spain, one's in Germany, then yeah, they're an international firm. And that may or may not be what you're looking for at that point in time. You may be looking for a UK-centric organization with some understanding of internationalization. And that would be fantastic if, for example, I'm working for a Spanish or a German, whatever organization, they're saying, we particularly want the UK, but we want people with an international mindset. then that might be exactly the right answer. 53 UK and 7 dotted here, there, and everywhere else. In other cases, no. The organization is looking for a balance across different geographies, in which case that organization wouldn't fit. So geography is a great one because it gives you that on LinkedIn. You can get a view of seniority as well. What's their pyramid? Is it a pyramid? Is it a barrel shape? Because you can tell from the job titles that they've got in there. So you get a view as to, are they really providing, you know, senior level advice? You know, the grey hair consulting approach that will come through. Equally so will the highly leveraged model with a bunch of juniors that will come through as well. And it's not that one is right and the other is wrong. It's just it depends what you're looking for at that point in time, and you can pick up from the likes of a LinkedIn what their organizational shape is. And when there are so many organizations in a space, very, very quick filters like that get you down to a target group of organizations to actually focus on.
I think it's a great reminder of the power of LinkedIn, Dave, and to your point, for anyone looking for acquisitions at the moment, actually just that insight that you get from someone's people page on their company. And like you say, it's never seemed to be an issue, but LinkedIn does create a level of transparency that most people don't give you on their own websites or own marketing material. But I don't think I've ever heard anyone who's complained about it. But to your point, actually, it's a great source if you are looking to understand, you know, acquisition targets, competitors. All the data's there, I guess, isn't it?
It is. It is, particularly in the UK. Less so in some other geographies. So in Germany, for example, some firms will use LinkedIn. Others use a thing called Xing. I don't know how you pronounce it. It's X-I-N-G. Lots of firms use that. So you have to then get across different platforms and look to see what you've got there. So that's useful. And then, you know, and then there are the other things, you know, Glassdoor. What are people saying on Glassdoor, if anything? Sometimes the Glassdoor is silent. Other times it's absolutely crammed full of information. So there are these different sources.
And I guess, like you say, when you overlay that qualitative data on the quantitative company's house, you get quite a rich picture of a firm. And I assume this is all before you've even spoken to them. This is putting together that target list. You may not be able to talk about the search we've been talking about here, but I'll ask the question and let you choose the example. Is we've talked about those that sort of what makes people fall into the Me Too. We've talked about what makes you decide if people are right. But I'd love it. Is there an example or an instance where someone's really grabbed you at that first stage, even if they weren't right further down the line? Is there any firm that stuck with you like, wow, they're the ones that got me really excited about potentially acquiring them?
Yes, but generally not from a desk research. It's generally when I'm in a space that I already know. And if I know the specific organizations, then I go, for this criterion, I'm going to contact this firm. I might do a little bit of desk research to update myself before I contact them, but I go, I've got a perfect fit here.
But that's more from your kind of network and pre-existing relationships than it is to your point that it's not you see someone's website and think they're going to be the ones.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Looking at a website, websites say what an organization wants them to say at a point in time. And a website may be 4 years out of date or may have been updated last week. So, and you can't tell if you've actually gone on it the first time. You can't immediately tell. I mean, you might get a feeling as to whether it looks a bit old school or not, but by and large, no. So no, the wow factor with firms that I haven't met before comes when I actually get to speak to them, and then I'm able to pick up whether there's something special here or not.
What gives you that first sense? What is that? Is it that first meeting and a first impression? Is it further down? If it's further down the process, we might leave it, but I'm just fascinated if there's something on those early phone calls or early Teams calls where you can tell this could be the one.
Yeah. When you're on the buy side, the first contact is the critical one. And my approach tends to be, I explain who I'm working for, sometimes by name, sometimes anonymously to start with. But I do make sure I explain exactly what I'm looking for.
In terms of firm profile?
Yeah, firm profile. Yeah, this is the sort of thing that we're looking for. And, you know, based on desk research, it would appear you might fit that. Firstly, it's putting them at their ease because they're not having to do the talking to start with. And secondly, it's given them a very clear route. So if they go, well, that's really interesting. Then yes, I can understand why you might have picked that up from you know, publicly available information, but that isn't really us. Then you close the conversation down really quite quickly. But a lot of the time, actually, you get the exact opposite, which is, oh, right, yeah, I can understand why you're contacting us then. And then they open up and then they start to tell you about their business. And within that first phone call, you know whether you want to meet them, because the next step really is, COVID aside, physically going to see them wherever that may be. And then you can really then lay out in more detail what you're looking for. You can get them to lay things out. Sometimes they're happy to do that up front. Other times they want to put an NDA in place. I don't mind. So yeah, but you generally pick up from that first call.
So turning to the acquirer side of the conversation, the business case for acquisition, and you will have presumably been involved in a lot of business cases for acquisitions. I'm interested in what are the kind of common themes. Is it simply its scale and growth, or are there other common themes that you see in the business case, the rationale for acquisitions? Because it's not a cheap process. It's, yeah, there's easier ways to do things. You could go organic growth. With the acquisition, they've got to engage someone like yourself. They've got to do the beauty parades we talked about. But what are those common themes, and what is it that drives the firms you work with to make those acquisitions? Again, for anyone thinking, I might do this, sort of, what are those good reasons to do it? And maybe what are the bad reasons why someone says it, but it's not always the best idea to do?
Sometimes the alternative that people think of, because it's going to be cheaper, is we'll do a team hire. And you're like, okay, how many people in this team? And where are you going to get them from? And are they available? And are they interested? And they're quite hard to do. I have done a couple of team hires, a lot of work, and quite a lot of risk, because it's at the end of the day, a group of human beings that have arms and legs. And if they don't quite like it, they can move on, because they're just an employee, really. Say just an employee, but you know what I mean? They're not locked in like you would do with a sale and purchase agreement. But equally, you bring in a team hire, by and large, they can't bring their clients with them, because those clients are contracted to the organization that they're walking out of. Whereas if you're buying the firm, you know, then you're, by and large, some differences if you're doing certain forms of asset purchase agreement, but by and large, you're doing a share purchase in the UK, certainly, then you'll be buying the client base as well. You'll be getting the MSAs as well as the staff. And so you're already getting a revenue and a profit stream from day one. Whereas with a team hire, you might have to wait 9 months before it starts to break even and then turns into a profit. So that's the alternative people think of, but they don't necessarily think through, oh yes, they can't work in their clients with them. We're going to have to pay them for a while before they sell some work, and it can take long. So people tend to go down the acquisition route because they get a faster result.
And just with that team hire, does that include hiring one person to build a team?
Not
at the
really
scale you're dealing with, that is just not a feasible option for the speed of growth.
No, I mean, you can hire, yeah, go and hire an important person out of that's known in the industry, or whatever, and ask them to set up a new practice for you. Yes, of course, that's part of organic growth, as far as I'm concerned. That's what you should be doing anyway, really. But no, if you want to do something a little bit more inorganic, you want to move in leaps and bounds, then you're really looking at the acquisition side.
And thinking on the acquisition side, have you ever seen, or are there ever trade-offs between buying an number of small versus one big? So, you know, just for simple round numbers, let's say you want 100 people, buying 100 person firm versus 250s or 330s and a few arms and legs. Again, I'd just be fascinated if that's ever featured and kind of why you see what the pros and cons are for either one.
Yeah, rough rule of thumb, it's a similar amount of effort to buy a 30 person firm than it is a 100 person firm. Rough rule of thumb. It would be a bit less effort if you're getting a 5-person firm, and it'd be a bit more effort if you're doing a 1,000-person firm. But between 30 and 100, it's roughly the same effort. So do you want to do it three times? and go through the effort and cost, or do you just want to do it once? Now, of course, you're then down to what's available in the market. Is there a 100-person firm doing what you want them to be doing? If yes, great. Go and focus in on them. If not, then you might have to do two or three chunks, and that can be okay. And there are examples of, you know, serial acquirers, firms, you know, generally non-UK organizations coming into the UK, and they are buying multiple firms in the 30 to 100 people size as they're looking to get to their 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 on a European scale or a global scale or whatever. So those models do work, and they come in and they're looking for a specific thing at a specific point in time. And then they've then got the integration headache of, we've now bought five firms in the UK and we've been through their earnouts, and now we've got to try and merge them. Well, if we're merging them, that means we've got to choose a head of the geography. Oh gosh, who's going to be head of the geography? And then you've got a tussle going on there. So it comes with its challenges. But equally, you know, you could say, go buy one larger firm that's fraught with risk in its own right. But then that's about doing the process properly and doing your due diligence properly and that sort of thing.
So that process point, because it was something I was interested to know as well, that we talked a lot about the start of the deal, almost what are those things you have to put in place to make sure the deal does go successfully? Because to your point of people being able to walk out the door, the obvious question or concern with a consulting acquisition is, well, will, you know, the people at the top pocket the money and everyone else just walk out the door? How do you ensure that that post-merger is as successful, or sort of post-acquisition phase is as successful as the acquisition phase itself?
Yeah. Well, firstly, you've got to make sure that business fit is there. I have seen a number of deals done by others in the market, and yeah, they were looking to buy, I don't know, some client logos. And so, great, we're now in Shell or HSBC or wherever, great, because we bought this firm. Fantastic. Yeah, but if they don't quite do what you do at the sorts of fee rates that you do it, and their cultural approach is different to yours, how long are those people going to stick around? So you've got to get that business fit and that cultural fit right. They are big. And then I do spend time, I like myself and the acquirer, to spend time with those senior people and actually have a bespoke conversation about what's right for that individual going forward. Because if you've got someone at the top of the firm and they're going to pocket a few million pounds, are they actually looking to retire? Or actually, do they just put that in the bank and then they carry on and they're still hungry? You know, what is it that's going to drive them going forward? And so I like to get honesty on that. And if we've got, I don't know, six people at the top of the firm and two of them really don't have fire in their belly for the future, that doesn't mean the deal doesn't happen. It just means that you have a bespoke answer for those two. And then the other four, you need to find out what motivates them and inspires them going forwards and ask yourself, are we able to provide that? And sometimes you are, and other times you're not. I mean, I remember a scenario in the last 3 years where we were buying a firm in the capital markets and the head of the firm was going to be pocketing a lot of money. But what inspired him was he wanted to be the global head of capital markets consulting, and how could he get there? And that was far more important than how much money was going in the bank. So that was great. So we found out what inspired the guy. We put a development path in place, and he's still there now. So that's great. But if others, you know, do want to go, then let them go. And then you look down to the second tier, and then you're then looking at, have we then got a model in place for the younger staff and the mid-ranking staff about how can they move up in our organization, and how does that vary against the career development path that they have in their current organization today? And if our approach can be seen to be an enhanced version of the one they've got, why wouldn't they stick around?
I really like that example, and I think brings to life that point, David, of actually think beyond the money. Because, you know, these conversations so often get focused on, well, this is the exit amount, and like you say, this is what you're going to get in your bank. But actually focusing on, yeah, what do people want on an individual level, and what's the proposition? I guess, as you've explained there, if you can leave everyone thinking they're getting exactly what they want and a better you know, employee experience, a better training, a better role, why would they leave? I guess it's really focusing on that as much as it is the kind of the commercial lock-ins, if you want to say something sort of financially as well. I want to turn to something you touched on way back at the start, and I think is a really key point around that Me Too problem. And I love what you said, you know, a firm of 30 with 30 propositions, because I think in our industry, we are cursed with being smart, being capable, and therefore we think we can do everything. And when you're running a small firm, it can seem like the safest bet is to, you know, bet on everything and say we can do everything, because then you're open to all. I'd love to get your take, though, on why actually honing those propositions is so critical. Obviously, it makes you appealing to an acquirer, I suspect, is one of them to our conversation just now. But why is that focus so important? And you know, particularly for your own firm or others that you've advised, kind of, yeah, you know, why is that, you know, one of your hot areas for all of the firms you work with?
It's not just about being attractive for an acquirer. If what people are doing is they're trying to refocus their firm in order to make them more attractive for sale, and that's the reason they're doing it, they'll probably struggle. They really need to be thinking about what's the right thing to do for their client market. And if the right thing to do for their client market is make it abundantly clear to, arbitrarily, the life sciences industry that they are clinical trial specialists, then they need to make sure they are clinical trial specialists, and they need to have case studies, and they need to have their propositions honed, and their website needs to say the right things, and they need to be speaking at the right conferences and writing the right articles in whatever life sciences journals people read. And then they become known, they become a legend in their own lunchtime, as it were. So now that will also make them attractive to an acquirer that wants to build up their presence in the life sciences sector. So almost make the attractiveness to the acquirer from the market positioning topic, make that attractiveness a byproduct of doing the right thing in the market.
And what are some of those common mistakes? We've touched on one, you know, having 30 propositions. What are some of those common mistakes you see either firms you work with or you know, targets you've looked at make? And I guess this might be a different tangent, but I'll ask at the same time, does that vary by size? You know, if you had to stratify firms, you mentioned, you know, when you were 30, is that different to when you're 100, to when you're 1,000 people firm?
Mm-hmm. Not really, is the answer. Yeah, you know, I'm doing it. I've taken over chairmanship of an organization that's PE backed in the last few months. And we've been through a strategy exercise, and this is a 1,000 person organization. And we've worked out, hone it all down to these two sectors, these specialist topics, and 1,000 person firm can be known for that and can grow from that. It's just the same at that scale as it is at the 10 person or the 20 person. So no, I think it's relevant right the way through. The reason it becomes a problem for the smaller firms is they do something that they, you know, they set up a firm because they're good at IT strategy or whatever. And they get their first few jobs, and then a client says, I know you're really good at IT strategy, but could you help with this IT operational issue over here? And they go, yeah, sure, we can do that. We can help you with that. And then they do that because it's helping the client. It's doing the right thing for the client, they feel at the time, and it helps keep the client sticky and grow the account and all that sort of stuff. Great. And then they think, oh, well, we've done a reasonable IT operations job for them. We'll now go and punt IT operations jobs elsewhere around the market. And then they get another client in IT operations and says, oh, well, can you help us with our cloud capacity? And they're, oh, yeah, sure, we can do that. And then they do some cloud capacity work. And before they know it, what was a very niche-focused IT strategy consulting firm commanding, I don't know, £1,800 a day, is now doing cloud capacity jobs and IT operations things, and they've had to drop their rates because the market pays £800 a day. They've just lost £1,000 a day off their fee rate by what they thought was helping clients out. So they've moved down market. Now, they might have wanted to do that, but you know, in the example, they've fallen into it. And it's now caused a problem because now they want to go back into their core market of IT strategy. And they've now done an IT operations job and a cloud thing and a capacity thing and a whatever thing for an organization. Now they're saying, oh, by the way, we can do IT strategy. And they're not known for IT strategy. And then the client expects that they'll do the IT strategy job for the same £800 a day. And, oh, now we got a problem. No, we do IT strategy, but we do it for £1,800 a day. And then the client says, but it's the same people. And then you've got a problem. So that's how you can fall into doing the wrong things, which were originally for really good reasons.
I'd never thought of it like that, but that's a really helpful and stark reminder of, like you said, the unintended consequences of just saying yes and actually strategically thinking about it. I wonder, and it may be the extension of the same example or a different one, that is a good reminder for why you should almost stick to your knitting, as it were. You mentioned, obviously, you've just done this with the firm you chair, and I have one particular example in my head where I spoke to a firm, I don't know, it was 15 partners, and they had kind of come to the conclusion they couldn't do this because the 15 partners would never agree. And because I don't know if it's a partnership or how the structure is, but yeah, 1,000 people means there's probably 100 partners or people of that level. How did you go on that journey to get everyone to agree? Because I guess in that world, you've got so-and-so, that's their offering, so-and-so, that's their offering. How do you get everyone to coalesce around two?
Yeah, it's really about getting your governance model right. If you're a 15-person firm, then you're probably, I don't know, 100 to 120 people, maybe. And so you will think that you're doing different things and your 15 partners will have different specialisms. But you've got to still agree what is the core direction of the firm. And if that means that one of the partners ends up not being part of the future because the other 14 have agreed this is the core and that 15th one doesn't do that, and no longer feels comfortable, then so be it. You have to make the right business decision and then deal with the consequences. And in that case, one of the consequences could be a partner needs to leave. But if you're still further up, you know, a larger firm, then you might say, actually, we're going to create, you know, we're now 40 partners. Well, we probably ought to have a management committee, which is a smaller group of partners. Maybe it's six, say. And it may be that you rotate some people in and out of that group of six over time. Or it may be actually they are the most senior six out of the 40. But you really do need to give decision-making ability to a smaller group. Doesn't mean that that smaller group isn't accountable to the larger 40 partners in that case. So, you know, there's an annual conference or something where you talk about the strategy that the smaller group has come up with and then the other 34 ratify it. You can do that, but you do need to cut it down to a smaller group. You can't have 15 partners and say, oh, let's have 15 different ideas for the direction of travel. You've got to be able to cut it down.
And I imagine this applies at all levels, but what drives that decision-making? And if it's data, what data? If it's, you know, to your point, kind of what you're known for in the market, how do you determine that? If you have, let's stick with our 15 partners for now. If you've got these 15, what would you be advising people to actually look at to start to guide, you know, if the goal is where you've got it, you know, 1,000-person firm can have two focus areas, 15 should be able to do the same. What should people be looking at to help them hone, okay, this should be our proposition?
Yeah, the age-old phrase of what do you want to be famous for is a good start point. Although, I mean, you ought to have an idea already because you probably are already famous for at least something. So that's the start point. And then you draw the concentric rings around that, which is if our core is this thing in the middle and then the thing's very closely aligned, we need to have capability and skill set and employees doing it. And then the next ring, well, that's where we might start to bring associates in as a bit of an overflow or specialist skills from time to time. You know, they're different. You know, diagrams that people use. After all, we're consultants. We love diagrams.
That's because is there a 2x2 that we can use?
Oh, There must be one of those. Yeah. So yeah, you just need to focus in on that core, and it may even be a direction of travel. I mean, I remember a few years back there was a smallish IT advisory firm, three guys at the top, equal owners, 33 1/3% each. And they were struggling to grow their IT advisory firm. They did great IT strategy jobs and quite a lot of IT architecture. And the problem with those types of jobs are, how often does an organization do an IT strategy? It's not doing it every week. So you do an IT strategy job and then you say to the client, I'll see you in 3 years' time. Oh, maybe we can help you with a bit of architecture off the back of it. But then when you built the architecture, what are you going to do then? So we actually built a model in some strategy workshops with their top three and then the next, I think there was another five underneath. So we had a group of eight people in these strategy workshops, and we came up with a diagram of IT strategy, architecture, and transformation. And they said, but we don't do the transformation bit. And said, well, no, you don't do today, but it's a natural consequence. If you position yourself with the client market, which is we'll help you with your strategy, we'll then map out what it looks like in architecture terms, and then we'll help you get there. And then the getting there is the transformation. And so what we'll do is we'll, as we position ourselves in the market there, we'll then start to be asked to carry on round to, into the transformation space. And then we can recruit in or whatever. And so we did that. And then they started meeting new organizations and explaining the whole diagram. And then they started getting asked to do transformation jobs. And then it was, oh, I need 12 people to put on this implementation phase. And, you know, you can manage it the first time or two. And then what happened quite quickly was, actually, we're now becoming known for this, but we need to have more of that downstream capability. And there was an intent eventually for a company sale and realizing value and that sort of thing. And so we went out to market looking for a larger organization that came from, you know, a program project change management background that had a lot more people that could help with that transformation phase. And it was just a natural thing to look for. And then those organizations similarly were saying, oh, well, what we're looking for is we're looking for something more upstream of what we're doing, because we like to have a seat at the C-suite table to talk strategy jobs, but we're known for program and project management. So we had multiple offers put forward by firms of that type because they were looking to move upstream and we needed that implementation capability. So we drew that diagram, going back, you know, to the original question, we drew that diagram of we're going to be known for three things. It just so happens when we drew the diagram, one of them they didn't do at all. But it worked.
I love that example, and it makes me think, David, of good to great with the flywheel and as you've described there, kind of what is that life cycle? Because actually, like you said, it can be a hard yards just doing strategy gigs if you haven't got the whole life cycle. I imagine someone listening is probably saying, well, that's great in principle, but if I don't do something, I almost, with one hand, we're saying cut out certain things that maybe low value or you're not as expert in. And that example is a great one of invest where there could be opportunity. How do you discern the difference?
Whether putting a new thing in is the right thing. Yeah, I think if I go back to when I had my own firm, or a group of us had our own firm, we used to agonize over where we were going to expand our offerings. Once we'd done the getting rid of 30 propositions for 30 people, and we'd got even bigger, and we used to agonize over, oh, is it right going here? When I look back on that, if I had my time again, I'd just make the decisions quicker. Because as long as there's a logic to a direction of travel, if there are two or three options, it doesn't really matter which one of them you choose, I often find. The key is it's logical. Make a decision, invest in it, make it happen. And if you've got the confidence also to say, and if it actually eventually doesn't seem to quite fit, you can always reverse out of it and then go back to the crossroads and go a different direction. And that's where confidence and self-confidence comes in.
So what I'm hearing is make a choice and test it is better than kind of analysis for, you know, the old analysis paralysis.
Correct. Yeah. I think of some of the internal workshops and the time wasting and everything that we used to do. It was nuts.
Well, and there's something in the two, you know, the fictitious one we talked about with the 15-person firm and with that one as well. And you touched on it there with confidence of, it almost feels like you you have to put the business before everything else. And I imagine in a, you know, to your point, where that firm was all partners are equal, or in a partnership where they may or may not be equal, but they're all partners, I imagine that is often the stumbling block of, you know, sort of hidden or not, is it's what's best for the business and everyone rallies around that.
Yeah, and you need to set some simple rules for that. So, you know, take the 1,000-person firm that are chairing now. We were working on the strategy and I got the leadership team together, and there were, I don't know, maybe 14, 15 people in the room. And at the very beginning, we said, right, when next couple of days, this is the sort of thing we're going to be doing. And no idea is a daft idea. So everyone should feel free and comfortable to put any idea on the table when we're discussing things. But when we come out in 2 days' time and we focused in on what it's going to be, whether you personally liked a specific part of the strategy or whether you preferred something that we decided not to do, the 15 of us, or I mean it was, when we walk out of the room, we will all sing the same tune, that we've been together for a couple of days, we've kicked around a load of ideas, we've come with a strategy, this is the strategy, and we are all behind that strategy. And if you can do that, then you've got, you know, you've got a winning formula.
Makes a lot of sense. And does it always work as easily in practice as it sounds in principle?
No. No, not always. Yeah, there's a small firm that I worked on strategy with them, and a director of travel, and four people at the top of the firm. And three of those four, very, very strong personalities. And each believed in their own idea. And they ended up with a bit of a camel, if I'm honest, coming out of it. I mean, the firm is still, I mean, they're still around today, still growing really well, actually. I think they're doing about 20 to 25% per annum turnover growth. So, you know, they're doing well. Ah, oh, but they could have done so much more.
I also love the camel metaphor as well. I'm inferring, because a horse would be much better. But David, I want to turn to a topic that has kind of been weaved through this, but it, again, to guests I've had on the show or haven't had on the show, I've had a number of people who do advisory work, but I've never actually talked to anyone about how to get into that world. Because, you know, we're sitting here and you mentioned that, you know, you've been doing it for sort of since you left Hitachi in 2009, not 2019. And it's one of those career paths that I suspect lots of people in our industry would want to get into, but unlike consulting, which is very linear and, you know, very clear of how to progress, advisory is less so. And I'd love if you could share for our listeners how you got into this world, because it's clearly, you know, you're now in it, spending a lot of time advising all the firms you are, but that first step into the advisor side, if you like, how did that come about?
So the first bit, as I explained at the top, was about deciding I didn't want a full-time job. So, yeah, you could do a startup 3 days a week, I suppose, but I decided no, and I decided I'd put back into my industry and help consulting and IT services firms with their own growth. In my case, I just put the word out. I didn't put a lot of effort into it, if I'm honest. I just made a few phone calls. I actually, back then, I'd ignored LinkedIn in all my working life up until 2009, then when I went out on my own, and then I started to talk to people about, what is this thing really? I've accepted loads of invitations over the years, but I don't do anything with them. I've never put a post out. And someone said, oh, no, you should do that. So I think I put a post out saying, oh, by the way, this is what I'm thinking of doing. And within a few days, I started getting some phone calls on my brand new phone that I'd had to buy, because I'd given Hitachi's phone back to them. And I put my phone number out on my LinkedIn profile, and then the phone started ringing. And my very first client was, David, you're going to help people with a turnaround? Yeah. Okay. I'm in trouble. How can you help? And that was the first one. And over the course of 4 years with that organization, I did little touch points, did a turnaround, helped put them on a growth path, and then eventually helped them package themselves up and sold them to one of the larger players, which was great. You know, for someone that was going to lose everything, ended up doing reasonably well out of it. So that was great. But yeah, I just, now it helped because I was known. So, you know, I was MCA president. I was known through that. I was on some industry groups. I'd been on a panel at the Bank of England. I'd done a few. So I was known for a few things, and that helps. So, I mean, otherwise, where's your initial credibility going to come from? You need some initial credibility. And for me, it was, I was a little bit of an industry figure. And yeah, could I have articulated turnarounds, growth strategies, and transactions at that point? No. In fact, initially, I thought, I know what I do. I'll do 5 or 6 non-exec director roles, and I'll do, you know, 2 or 3 days a month on each. That'll be fine. And I did no non-exec director roles for the first 12 years. It was all, can you come and help me with this? And it was all largely, you know, projects with a beginning, a middle, and an end. You know, I need to turn the thing around. I'm stuck on growth strategy. I need to know where to focus. I want to grow internationally. Where should I go first? And so they're all sort of short, sharp things to start with. And then it then got into the acquisition side of things, and they tend to be slightly longer, more involved exercises on either the buy side or the sell side. And then that in itself, then, I found, opens the network up further. If you're taking a firm to market on the sell side, which is, you're quite right from what you said earlier, that is where most people tend to go, because you've actually got a something. I've got one of these. Would you like to buy it? That's easier than saying, I'm looking to buy something. Do you fit? And it's quite hard to get them to answer the phone when you're contacting a target on the buy side. So it is probably harder the buy side than the sell side.
I think we've covered a lot of ground there in terms of how you got started. And I think that part of me really wants to ask what the first LinkedIn message or your first LinkedIn post was. But to your point, it doesn't sound like you had the kind of clear value proposition you do now. But actually, you mentioned you thought it was going to be non-exec stuff, and you got kind of, you know, these turnaround projects with the client you mentioned. Were those early years of your advisory career, did you fulfill your wish of doing 3 days, or was it full-time, just shorter sort of fractional gigs, if you like, or interim gigs?
Yeah, initially it was small gigs, and I wasn't anywhere close to 3 days a week back then. I'm now probably more like 6 days a week, but which is way more than I should be doing, but I love it, so why not? But no, in the early days it was small things, because you sort of need to go and showcase and prove that actually you can do that. Not just for your own firm that you know intimately, but for someone else's firm, and help them through that. And I was also concerned at the beginning that I was so used to coming up with the ideas and making the decisions. How would I actually come across? Would I come across as a bit of a dictator? This is the answer. This is what you should do. And hence be sort of making the decision for them. Or would I actually genuinely be looking at options, and the fact that I'd have gone down one path and they want to go down another path, does it matter? It was a bit of a voyage of discovery at the beginning. So I was actually quite happy to take it slowly to start with and work out what my style was going to be. And in the end, someone coined a phrase a while back that, if you think of coaching and mentoring and consulting and all those things, I'm generally sort of known as being an opinionated mentor. And I quite like that as a phrase, because it means I can help them along the journey. But if they want me to give an opinion, then I've probably got one.
I love it. I was going to ask what your style was, and I think you've there perfectly answered it, David. And your point around kind of it was, inverted commas, easy for you, but you'd put the groundwork in before. I guess that is probably your advice to others. So what I might ask is, if someone was eyeing this side of the industry up, is a prerequisite that you have been, you know, you've run your own firm, or that you've been a managing partner? Or actually, if there are people listening who haven't done that, but like the idea of, I don't know, in 5 years going into the advisory side, is that still a route open to them? Is it more about what you said, getting credibility through memberships or through sort of roles outside your firm? Or actually, do you have to have been at that top of a firm to have that as an opening, as a career path?
Yeah. I mean, there are a number of us, not that many, but there are a number of us that do similar sorts of things. Most of us have done the full life cycle of founding a firm, growing it, and selling it. most of us in this advisory side have done that. Not all, but most. But there's no reason why, you know, if someone is the partner in charge of strategy for a mid-sized firm and they want to branch out and they want to do that, and they may think, you know, what I can do is I can help lots of different firms with their strategy. Well, if you've done it for a firm internally and the numbers have shown that it worked, then why couldn't you do that? You still need a network, though, because new business sales, as everybody knows, is pretty hard. Pretty hard. So a network really helps. So, you know, get involved in, you know, one of the industry bodies. There are plenty of them now, from the Consultancy Growth Network for small firms through the MCA for larger firms, or, you know, even through the Worshipful Company of Management Consultants, if you like.
There's a livery company for consultants, right, as well.
So, yes, you know, and you're doing pro bono jobs, but you're getting known through doing it. There's no reason why you can't go, you know, there. So go and get known somehow. You know, it could be through a client side body. You know, if your consulting firm does lots of work for PE houses, then, you know, maybe you get involved in the PE community, which once you do get known, you start getting passed around from one firm to another firm. So it could, you know, it could be that, or it could be, you know, you're well known in, I don't know, the retail sector, because that's been your key client facing side, and then you make use of your contacts in there to get networked back in to other consulting firms that operate in that sector. You've got to somehow get your network going, and then you've got to have a reason why you, and it could be because you've done strategy, or it could be because you've done the life cycle, it could be because you've done a few M&A jobs or whatever.
I really like that, and I guess talks to what we were speaking about with proposition as well, doesn't it? Ultimately, it's a proposition of one, and like you say, it's getting that network so that people know you. You're having a proposition, so they know what you stand for or what, why they might engage you, and then building that BD funnel as you did. Obviously, it came quickly through your LinkedIn message, but actually, that point of, if people don't know you, this isn't the sort of thing you go out to job boards to find roles for, is my sense with advisory.
No, I don't. No, I haven't heard of that on a job board.
Well, and there's another, so, and you touched on it about, you know, how much you love it and kind of the firms you've worked with, but the other interesting part of your advisory journey is you've kind of stepped up, I'm being very crude here, but stepped up firms throughout the time you've done advisory in terms of size and scale, is my understanding. I might be wrong there. And how you've done that as well, because to your point, the advisory community is small, and from people I see in that space, to what you said around network and proposition, people tend to go in with a, yeah, I'm the small firm man or woman, or I'm the big firm man or woman, and they kind of stay there. And it sounds like throughout your advisory journey, you've, if there was such a thing as a ladder, you've climbed that. How have you done that? You mentioned M&A. Is it that M&A and those connections that have helped you do that? And I guess also, David, what has led you? Why have you wanted to kind of grow that reach of your advisory work as well?
Yeah, so I'd never really focused at the outset on whether I was going to help small firms grow or large firms grow or diversify or whatever. And I found I was doing a mixture of both from the outset, actually. So one of what is now the Big Four, it wanted me to go and be a partner in their financial services practice, and I said no. And eventually I'm sat with the head of Europe, and they said, well, look, I can't let you go. Let's have a conversation here. And next thing, we identified that they wanted to grow inorganically. They wanted to buy firms up to 50 million turnover. They owned a corporate finance house, but the corporate finance house doesn't get out of bed for anything less than a billion. And so they didn't know the market. And so, you know, we took a couple of people off their bench, and I set up a little internal M&A function. And next thing, I'm the M&A function for initially the UK and then other areas of Europe for one of the Big Four. And that was really early on, whilst also helping, you know, the guy who was about to lose his firm, and later on we grew it. So I've done the large and small to start with. But you're right that over time, I'm doing more for mid to large firms now than I was. That sort of suits me, because if you're working for lots of the smaller firms, you're having to do a lot of them because they can only afford a certain amount of your time and they've only got a certain amount of time themselves to spend with you. Whereas if I can do a smaller number of larger things, it's a bit less stressful.
I guess back to, like you said, with M&A, if it's the same amount of work to do one big as three small, or sounds like actually it's, sorry, more work to do the three small than it is the one big. David, I think we've covered a lot there and certainly helps my listeners in terms of if they did want to get into that space. If we had more time, we'd probably talk all about the journey as running a big four M&A function, because that's a great thing to put on your CV or onto your marketing. But that brings us nicely to the end of today. And I always end with two questions. And you teased me at the start of this by saying your answer to the book one, I think, was going to surprise me. So I'll ask that first, which is, what is the book or books that have either had the biggest impact on you or you've given to others most? And why is that?
Yeah. So maybe the surprise is there isn't a specific answer. So I decided when we co-founded our firm, and there I was, the ripe old age of 24. And, you got operations directors of insurance companies taking advice from me, like, why? And I thought, what I need to do is read a load of books and then I'll be, more rounded and more expert and that sort of thing. And so I bought a load of books and then I found that I didn't really read them because that's not really my way of learning. And what I learned over time was what I need are the two diagrams and an explanation of how those diagrams work. And you can throw the rest of the book away. That's the way that I learn. So I went from buying the books to having them gathering dust. And then I thought I had at the time a half hour drive each way to the office. And so I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll listen to books. So I bought the tapes, as they were back then. And I'd listen to a tape on the way into Teddington, where our office was, and I might listen to a book on the way back. And then I realized I wasn't really listening to the book at all. And it was only after that I realized, yeah, actually, give me the two diagrams and an explanation, and that's all I need, really. And so I don't have a specific book. There are some, classics.
I feel I should ask, is there a diagram that sticks with you? Is there a...
No, I'm a consultant. Give me a diagram. I'll work out what to do with it.
I love that. And I get a real mix. Some people love books, David. Some people don't. I've had YouTubes. I've had podcasts. I think nothing. The diagrams, like you say, that is what consultancy is made from, isn't it? And then the last question, and this is one that may recap some of the things we've talked about, or may not, but it's to give advice to three people. So the first is a bit like you were just starting your career at Anderson. It's someone just coming out of university, just going in as an analyst. The second person is someone, I always know it as manager level, if you wanted to use kind of Accenture parlance. And the third one is someone approaching partner, or that partner step. So that could be someone going out on their own. It could be someone who's going to be a partner in a bigger firm. It might be someone who's coming onto the leadership team in your firm as was. And the question, quite simply, is what one piece of advice would you give to each of those people?
So I think the someone just starting out, join a firm where you'll get a variety of experience and you will get some fairly well-structured training. Because you've just come out of university, you think you know everything. Actually, it's just like, you've got a degree, so your A-levels are now irrelevant. And your A-levels became irrelevant. Your O-levels were irrelevant when you got your A-levels. So actually, you've got your degree. It's going to become irrelevant pretty quickly in the main. Sometimes specialist degrees and that sort of thing. But so no, you need to go back. You need to get your base training. So go get that and get a variety of experiences. That's the, I think, for the starting out. Then when you're coming through to manager, what are you now? For 5 to 8 years experience, then you really ought to have worked out what is it that actually excites you about consulting. Is it managing teams of people to get an outcome for a client, in which case you'll go one sort of direction? Is it you love being a specialist in whatever it is? Cybersecurity or something, and you want to become, one of the people that writes the books in that topic? Is it that, whatever it is, you should really be choosing a something so that you can start to do more of what you enjoy and become more expert at it. I think that's what I would say to that sort of 5 to 8 year experienced person. And that will then define your path, because if you're going to become a technical specialist in something, then you're more likely to carry on down a specialism be known as a guru in a topic, but you probably won't be managing partner of a firm. Whereas if you're more around, I love the client journey, I love the stakeholder management, I love the management of people, you're more likely to end up as the managing partner of the firm, but you might, you know, but you won't have a technical specialism. You may not. So each to their own, really. And it's around that time that you really need to make that decision. And the third one was coming on to partner.
Yeah, someone approaching partner.
Yeah, I think there you're asking yourself, what do you want to be doing in life in 10, 15 years time? Is it, you know, you're going to be joining the partner team because you've got, I don't know, Barclays Bank as a key account and you've grown it from nowhere? Then is it you want to be head of financial services? In which case, what does that mean? Is it you want to carry on down a general management route? In which case, what does that mean? I think the other thing about going into partnership is, are you going to buy your partnership, or are you expecting it to be given to you on a plate? And most of the time, you're buying your partnership, or may not be partnership, maybe a limited company, you're buying a shareholding. That's a big decision. So are you committing yourself to that direction of travel for the next 10 to 15 years? It's a very big decision, because if you are, then you are making a commitment, but you're also telling yourself that you're 7 days a week working, because let's not kid ourselves, this is not a 5 day a week job when you're moving up to partner level. You know, you're 7 days a week. It's not 7 days a week all the time, but, you know, you're constantly on call. You're doing crazy hours. You're traveling around. Is the lifestyle that you want to have commensurate with that? Because it may be, in which case, fine. But it may not be. And it would be an awful bore if you went down that route and then 15 years later, you look backwards and say, why did I do that? I've hated the last 15 years. I've worked crazy hours. I've been doing things I don't like doing. I've been working with people I don't enjoy spending time with. It's quite a big decision, embarking on that. Most people think that, you know, being selected to be a partner or to join the board or whatever is the critical thing. You must position yourself so you get selected. But actually, it's a two-way process.
I think a fantastic piece, I think all great advice, but a fantastic piece to leave us on, especially in a world where we focus a lot on numbers. Yes, remembering, is this actually something you will enjoy? And will you look back on those 15 years fondly is an important thing to remember. I think that very much does bring us to the end. So the only other thing to ask for anyone who's enjoyed this, wants to find out more about yourself, David, where would you point them to? Where can they find out more?
I have a small website. So davidbailey.consulting. So set that up a few years back when these new domain names came out.
Very good. You're the first person I've met who has got a .consulting domain.
Perfect. So davidbailey.consulting. And there you can go from links through there to my photography website, which is another topic, and onto my LinkedIn profile, which you think is davidbailey47. So you never forget my birthday, the 4th of July. So there you go. This, you'll find me on either of those.
Fantastic. Well, we'll put a link to the website there so that everyone can find you. And like you say, find out. We didn't get to touch on photography, but it will all be there for others to look at. We've got the LinkedIn as well. People can scroll back through and find the post where it all began if they so wish. But David, this has been great. Thank you very much. And all the best for the rest of your week.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
Cheers.
Today's episode is brought to you by Create Engage, the specialist digital marketing agency for the disruptive management consultancy. Now, for long-time listeners, you will probably already know who we are. You may have even heard one of our ads on a previous episode of this podcast. But for those of you who don't, here is a short introduction. At Create Engage, we help you create an effective marketing strategy for your consultancy, a strategy that will resonate with your target clients. And then we support you by delivering the campaigns you need to turn that strategy into a reality, helping you to build your brand, raise your profile with your prospective clients, and ultimately generate return on investment from your marketing activity. Now, I could tell you about many of the great clients that we work with and the results we've delivered for them. But instead, I'm going to do something much more powerful and something that I would recommend you do for your own marketing. I'm going to let our clients do the talking for us. If you are currently thinking about marketing for your consultancy, you're going to want to listen to this.
Create Engage started the process for us. They managed it end to end. They came up with some really creative ideas, and we were really happy with the work that they did, which meant that we could just focus on running the business. Not only did we start conversations with clients that we hadn't spoken to before, but also there was tangible return on investment by some work that we were given.
They've helped right from the initial shaping of the idea through to helping us work out what our end goal was. They've supported us with the visual identity and our positioning of the brand.
We've had an immediate expansion of our network and have initiated a raft of new conversations with owners, CEOs in target client organisations, and has led to us winning new projects already.
One of the greatest compliments, I guess, is that one of our competitors even said that they really like what we're doing with marketing and they wish they could be doing something as good.
So from our perspective, we couldn't recommend Create Engage any more than this.
I would certainly recommend Create Engage if you're a consulting firm. They really understand consultancies and the sort of challenges we face. And I don't think you're going to get much better marketing anywhere else.
So I wouldn't hesitate to recommend Create Engage. They did a really good job for us.
So if you're looking for an agency that can help you achieve the results that our clients just described, then head to our website, createengage.co.uk, where you can find out more about how we support consulting firms like you. You can download our latest ebook and you can get in touch to talk about how we can help you take your consultancy to the next level through digital marketing. I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Climbing Consulting. If you have any guest recommendations, comments, ideas, thoughts on how I can make this show better for you, just drop me an email. It's nick@createengage.co.uk, and I really look forward to hearing from you.